Now we'll take a few questions. We have a few minutes left. Yes. Yeah.
Revelation 14 talks about 144,000. And, you know, I know you like to take numbers, but there'll be a vast number of people who are saved. You know, but we'll expect there to be a vast number of people who are destroyed. But among the living, at the time of Jesus comes, there will only be like 8, I'm not saying 8, but a comparable amount. Do you know what time?
Well, you know, the book of Revelation, and this was one of the questions that was in here that I didn't specifically read. It contrasts the faithful at the end. It refers to them as 144,000. Whereas the enemies of God's people are symbolized by 200 million. And I don't think that God is saying that the wicked are going to be 200 million, not one more, not one less. What it's doing is it's creating a contrast. The great multitude of the earth are going to be opposed. And there's only going to be a handful of God's people. It's not going to be 8. It's going to be more than 8. But, you know, it's going to be a small group compared to the number of people who have chosen the side of the devil. And that's not to surprise us, because that's the way it's been all throughout the course of human history. The majority of people side with the devil. And so those who say, you know, the mega church movement says the bigger the church, the more it is a sign that this is God's church. No. Because if numbers were the barometer, then the devil would have the most successful church in the world, because most people are on his side.
Why?
So we don't have to be concerned about numbers. We have to be concerned about piety. Back there against the wall.
Wait, we have a mic because we need this.
Oh, okay. Okay, all right.
In Exodus 14, when God says He hardened the hearts of Pharaoh, what did He actually do, or what does this verse actually mean?
Okay, thank you very much. That's a good, excellent question. It's asked frequently. When in the Bible, what God permits is attributed to God. In other words, what God allows, the Bible speaks as if God did it. And maybe I can give you an illustration. When the sun shines on ice, what does it do? It melts it. When the sun shines on clay, what does it do? Hardens it. So it all depends what the element does that the sun shines on that determines whether it softens or hardens. Did God shine fullness of light upon the Egyptian civilization in the days of Moses? Yes, He did. But what did Pharaoh do? He hardened his heart. So indirectly, it was the message that hardened his heart, but God isn't to blame because He wanted to soften. Pharaoh hardened his heart. And if you look at other verses there, in the first 14 chapters of Exodus, there are texts that say that Pharaoh hardened his heart. So there are verses in there that say that God hardened his heart, and there are verses that say that Pharaoh hardened his heart. You know, the story of Job is similar. Right? You know, did God cause all of Job's problems? No. And yet, did it appear that God had caused them? Yes. Did God permit it?
Yes.
And because God permitted it, it's attributed to God, even though God did not directly do it. What God permits is attributed to God, even though God does not actively do it, and therefore He's not responsible for it. So basically, that's the gist of Pharaoh hardening his heart. Okay, over there.
Can you expound on the King of the North and King of the South in Revelation?
Okay. It's actually in Daniel, but... I'll give you a short answer. In the Bible, the North and the East are the directions of the compass of God. The West and the South are the directions of the compass of the devil. And you say, why is that? Because it has to do with the position of the sun. The sun rises in the east. It reaches its deepest and highest intensity when it's directly overhead in the north. Because north is up. See, God's throne is in heaven, in the sides of the north. So north is up, south is down, east is to the right, and west is to the left. And that's why, you know, in Amos 8, it says that at the end time, many people will run from sea to sea and from north to east seeking the Word of God. They wouldn't go to the west and to the south, because the west is where darkness begins, and in the south, it's where the darkness reaches its deepest intensity. And that's, by the way, in math, the positive quadrants are east and north, and the negative quadrants are west and south. However, the devil has tried to usurp God's position as the king of the north. He sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. He was not able to do it in heaven. So what he does is he sets up his headquarters in the temple of God on earth. So the devil is the counterfeit king of the north. And his apostate religious system, the papacy, is, because ancient Babylon was the king of the north. You look at Jeremiah, ancient Babylon was the king of the north. And of course, Babylon is the papacy. And so the king of the north in the end time, spiritually speaking, is Babylon or the papacy, which is the king of the north. Because in the Bible, the king of the north is Babylon, because it's north of Israel. In order for Babylon to come against Israel, they had to come across the Fertile Crescent, and then they had to come down from the north to attack Israel. The king of the south was Egypt, because it was geographically south. And what was the main characteristic of Egypt? The main characteristic of Egypt was defiance of the true God. It did not profess to serve the true God. It defied the true God. Ellen White says atheism. So it says that at the time of the end, the king of the north would be attacked by the king of the south. When is the time of the end? The time of the end begins in 1798. I won't take the time to prove that. You have to go to Daniel 12 to prove that. But the time of the end begins in 1798. So it says that at the time of the end, the king of the south would attack the king of the north. Let me ask you, did anything happen between 1793 and 1798 that affected the papacy negatively? The French Revolution and the taking captive of the Pope in 1798. And France, the French Revolution was an atheistic attack on the Roman Catholic Church. That's why the king of the south in 1798 is not literal Egypt. It represents a power that has the atheistic characteristics of Egypt. I don't know the Lord, and I will not let his people go, is what Pharaoh said. But then it says that the king of the north rises against the king of the south, and basically he overwhelms and controls the world. That is speaking about the healing of the deadly wound that the king of the south gave the king of the north in the time of the end. So, you know, that's just in a nutshell. I recommend that you go to Audioverse and listen to Reflections on Daniel 11. And you'll find a lot more there. Also, Lewis Weir has written a book called The King of the North at Jerusalem, which is very good, where he deals with this concept of the King of the North and the King of the South.
Pastor.
Okay? Yes.
The 7 days between the flood happening and Noah entering the ark, could that be a parallel? Because I heard that when Jesus is coming back, that the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens, and that there will be a time where it's just coming and coming, but nothing's really happening. Could that be considered a parallel?
I don't think the 7 days could specifically, because this time of trouble takes place from the close of probation all the way till the coming of Jesus. And that is just those 7 days are the last segment of the time of trouble. It's at the very end of the time of trouble. So we don't apply the time periods. These time periods were literal in the Old Testament story. When you come to apocalyptic prophecy, the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation, then the time periods obviously are symbolic. But these time periods that are in stories, there's no evidence that you're supposed to take the time periods as being typological. It's the events that are parallel, not the time periods.
Where? Right here. Okay. I wanted to kitty up with his. Were you referring to the one from Revelation 8:1 when it says, "And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour," yeah, where people have talked about That's the time it takes from heaven to get here.
I agree.
That's what you're alluding to?
I agree.
Okay.
I agree that that particular time period is talking about that. In fact, Ellen White, I wish I had time to talk to you about the seals. But the seventh seal, where you have this space of about a half an hour, is the time that it takes Jesus, from the time you see this cloud, about the half the size of a man's fist. That begins the 7 days, and Jesus descends. And then Ellen White says that as he descends, there is a period of awful silence. And then a voice is heard saying, "Who shall be able to stand?" And that is the very passage in Revelation where, you know, when Jesus comes seated on the white throne, what do the people say? Who shall be able to stand? And she doesn't quote Revelation 8 verse 1, but she speaks about the awful period of silence. And then she says that the period of silence is broken once Jesus arrived, when Jesus says, "My grace is sufficient for you." So Jesus will answer, "Who is able to stand?" It's only by the grace of Christ that he has a group that will be able to stand. So Revelation 8 verse 1 does refer to that period of 7 days.
Can you expound on some of those that are going to suffer actually three deaths?
Yeah, there are some that are going to suffer three deaths. Those who resurrect in the special resurrection of the wicked will die three times. By the way, there are some righteous people that will also die twice. For example, Lazarus. See, the exception merely proves the rule. See, there are two general resurrections. But then there is a special resurrection. There was also a special resurrection when Jesus resurrected. Right? But these are exceptions to the rule. But, pardon me? They're in heaven. Yes, they're in heaven now. Basically, what the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy teach, to give you a short answer, is that when God's voice is heard delivering his people, when the voice says, "It is done," at that time, the living saints, 144,000, will be changed at the twinkling of an eye. And those who died in the faith of the third angel will also resurrect. And those who pierced Jesus and were the greatest enemies of the truth, they will resurrect. And they will see Jesus coming on the clouds. And then, of course, those who resurrect will be transformed. But those evil people who resurrect, they will die again by the brightness of the coming of Jesus. After the millennium, they will resurrect. And then they will die in the second death. Technically, it's a third death, but the second death simply means the death from which there will be no resurrection. So there are exceptional cases. Like there were exceptional resurrections too, you know. Like Enoch. Enoch was translated to heaven from among the living. Moses died and resurrected and went to heaven. So there are exceptional cases. Oh, over here. We need to do it with the microphone. Yes.
In what book did Ellen White comment on the silence in heaven?
Oh, in Great Controversy, in the chapter God's People Delivered. There she doesn't quote Revelation 8 verse 1. But she says that there's a period of awful silence. And then she says that the question is, who shall be able to stand? And then it is heard, "My grace is sufficient for you." So you, once again, you have to look at the structure of what she says and find where it fits within the biblical context. Yes.
Before the flood, I understand that there was a canopy of water around the earth, and
right.
Also that the sun shone seven times hotter. What was the original design or the reason that all came down from before the flood, and then the sun is now a seventh as hot to
survive? Well, I'm not sure that the seven times hotter is linked specifically with that. What I can say is that the earth was covered by a canopy of water. But the Bible's clear on that point. And that's basically the reason why there was a uniform climate all over the world. There were not the polar regions, you know, extreme heat and extreme cold. But of course, after the flood, you know, God brought all the water down that he had placed above, and he took all the water that he placed beneath at creation, and he brought it up, and he filled the earth with water like it was before creation week. And so, you know, and this is the reason why scientists cannot read nature today correctly, because it's totally different than what it was after creation before the flood. It's radically different. So they're trying to read nature independently of Scripture that gives a reason why things are so different. And that's why they reach wrong conclusions. So it had never rained before the flood. You know, the water that God placed underneath, at certain hours of the day, the heads of the sprinkler system popped up and the earth was watered by a mist. Okay, where's the microphone?
Over here.
Over there, okay.
Yeah, in the last study, we read the quote from Ellen White, The Great Controversy, and it's talking about when the wicked stop. And the last sentence says, with fearful forebodings, they gaze upon the symbol of God's covenant and long to be shielded from its overpowering brightness.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what the symbol of God's covenant is.
Ellen White, in other places, explains that at this time, God is going to show his Ten Commandments in the heavens. And what is the sign that identifies the commandment giver? The Sabbath. If you continue reading, it's in the next chapter, it says that the men discovered that the Sabbath was truly the sign between God and his people. So that's the sign that is visible that they're able to see. And that's why they see that their ministers have deceived them. See, they're going to say, you guys said that we're supposed to go to church on Sunday. Because Jesus resurrected. But now, God is showing us in the heavens that it was Sabbath all the time. You rascals. And that's why they're going to turn upon them when God reveals his law in the heavens. They're actually going to say a lot worse than you rascals. I'm just being kind. Okay, back here.
Using the principle that Emmanuel Bach taught us a little bit earlier in the seminar of typological consistency as a whole while we're doing this, looking at Noah's time, reflecting on the end time in Revelation chapter 14, particularly the first angel's message saying that the everlasting gospel is preached to the entire world. The question is the only evidence that we have of Noah's preaching filling the entire world the destruction of the entire world?
Well, no, because we have in Genesis chapter 6 that it says the whole earth was filled with violence. So you have a clear indication that the whole earth was populated. And some people say, well, you know, how was Noah able to share his message on a worldwide scale? And I'll simply tell you, I believe that they had a much more advanced technology than we do. You know, listen, folks, they had 20 times the mental energy that we have. And they could work on projects for hundreds of years. In fact, Ellen White has a statement in Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, the volume on the flood, where she says that these individuals did not need books because they had powerful memories, and everything that they saw, they could retrieve. I mean, and you're thinking that they lived in caves, and they were half-dressed, and they ran around killing dinosaurs? That's the evolutionary model, see? We're the sophisticated ones. See, the earlier you go in history, the more primitive they are. That's the evolutionary model. That's not the biblical model. The biblical model is that the farther back you go, the more intelligent people were, and the more capable, and the more they use the resources that God gave them for evil. So, you know, the whole earth was filled with violence. The whole earth needed to be cleansed and needed to be destroyed. So I think there's enough evidence in the Bible to indicate that the whole earth was populated. And also, if you do the math, 1,656 years, probably hardly any infertility, hardly no disease. I mean, how many children can a 900-year-old man have? Especially when God said, be fruitful, multiply. There was no scarcity. You didn't have to say, well, how are we going to make ends meet? The world produced abundantly. All you have to do is sit down. You know, I had someone who does statistics. I said, would you please calculate, put all these factors into the computer. He said there had to be at least 2 billion people before the flood, which means that the earth was totally populated. So, the mind-boggling thing is there were only 8 people faithful that were left. So that's a mind-boggling thought. Okay. Yes.
If you travel around the world, you go to China, Thailand, India, you see these images of a mom with a baby. And it preceded, way preceded the coming of Christ in such a supernatural God. How did the devil know to counterfeit so soon? That's one. The other one is, what do you think about the 1888ers?
Listen.
1888ers.
The devil knew Genesis 3:15. He knew that there was going to be a woman who was going to have a child. And that child was going to crush his head. So he knew long before that there was going to be a mother and her child. And so what did he try to do? He tried to counterfeit it before it took place. That's why in all these civilizations you find a mother figure, not only in Buddhist countries, but in Hinduism, in Roman Catholicism, all over the world you have this idea, and ancient pagan religions, where you have a mother and her child. Why? Because the devil tried to preempt what God was going to do through Jesus Christ. Ellen White says that the devil is a perceptive observer. She says that when the first sacrifice was offered, he reflected, he thought, he said, somehow this is going to interrupt the communion between, is going to reestablish communion between man and God, and it's going to interrupt my power. And as he continued observing the spotless lamb, and then being slain, the hand being placed on the head of the animal, the confessing the sin, he put two and two together. He said, that has to represent Jesus. And he knew he was waiting for Jesus when Jesus came. That's the evidence. When Jesus was born, he was waiting for him. And by the way, all throughout the Old Testament, he's trying to prevent the seed from coming. You have the story of Joseph, for example. We've totally missed the point in the story of Joseph. You study the story of Joseph, man, how unjust it was what happened to that poor guy. I mean, he gets sold by his brothers to Egypt. He's a good kid, obedient to his brothers. He liked to rub it into his brothers, But that doesn't justify them selling him. And so he's sold to Egypt. Unfair. And then because he refuses to commit adultery, he ends up in prison. Totally unfair. But Ellen White says that when he was on his way to Egypt, he made up his mind that God had a plan for him. He didn't know. He knew that God was doing something, but he didn't know what. Well, as the story unfolds, you know exactly what's happening. You know, the Pharaoh has his dreams. There's going to be 7 years of famine. And at the very end of the story, Joseph gives the real reason why he was led down to Egypt. He says in Genesis 45, he says, the Lord has sent me down to Egypt before you to preserve the seed. It was the devil's intention to wipe out Jacob and his family because he knew the seed was going to come from that family. That's the real agenda of the devil behind the story of Joseph. In every story in the Old Testament, you have to look from that perspective. The devil is trying to prevent the seed from coming. And finally, when the seed comes, he says, he's here. I'm going to nip this in the bud. I'm going to kill him when he's born. And all throughout his life, he tries to infect Jesus with sin. He tries to discourage Jesus. On the cross, he tries to convince him to get down from the cross and leave and get sent. He says, go back to heaven. Look, all your disciples are gone. This isn't going to do anything. Save yourself. So he's trying to convince him to leave. Because he knows that if Jesus dies, that's it. He's finished. When Jesus said, it is finished, the devil said, I am finished. Okay, time is up. Pardon me? The 1888ers, listen, there's so much that people have to say about 1888. And righteousness by faith. Look, Ellen White put it succinctly. The 1888 message is simply the righteousness of Christ, which is made manifest in obedience to all of the commandments of God. That's the nutshell, the bottom. You know, I have nothing against people who study the 1888 message, but there's many other things besides the 1888 message which are extremely important in the history of the Adventist Church. 1888 was a watershed event, very important event, no doubt whatsoever about it. And we need to embrace the message of 1888 because Ellen White says it was the beginning of the loud cry. By the way, I'm going to have a fuller explanation of what all of this means if time lingers. 3ABN has asked me to come next year in September. I know it's a ways off. Hopefully Jesus will come before that. But if not, I'm going to be doing a five-part series at their camp meeting. And it's going to have to do with righteousness by faith. And there's five sermons. One is called Weaving the Robe. The second one, the title is Claiming the Robe. The third one is Examining the Robe. The fourth one is Wearing the Robe. And the fifth one is Without a Robe. And it's going to be a different, unique way of presenting righteousness by faith. You know, the objective aspects of righteousness by faith and the subjective aspects of righteousness by faith. So stay tuned. It's in Selected Messages, Volume 1. That's all I can tell you. You know, it's towards the second half of Selected Messages, Volume 1. Oh, that's in the chapter God's People Delivered. Okay, well, time is up, folks. Let me say it's been a pleasure being with you. It's an invigorating experience for me to be around you. No, I've been energized by you. And praise the Lord. Please invite me again.